And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman on this Tuesday afternoon. Well, this hour we discuss how the Affordable Care Act will affect Floridians. Will the average worker pay more or less for health insurance? What about those who are currently uninsured? Joining us now is Florida Blue Senior Vice President of Public Policy, Government, and Community Affairs. He's Jason Altmaier. He's been a three-term congressman from Pennsylvania, and Florida Blue is the only insurer which will offer insurance policies in all Florida counties. Welcome to you, Mr. Altmaier.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And also joining us is Edward Paswali. He's a litigator, political advisor, and president of the law firm of Tripp Scott. He's a past chairman of the Republican Party of Broward County and chairs the National Multiple Sclerosis Society of South Florida. Welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. I guess I'll ask you first, Edward Paswali. One in four Floridians are without health insurance. More than a million South Floridians are without it as well. The bulk of those reside in Miami-Dade County. Broward County, more than a third of residents are under or uninsured. Do you think they'll benefit from the Affordable Care Act?
We really don't know enough yet. I mean, today is the first day of enrollment on the individual mandate where people can go to the exchanges, assuming that the computer glitches have been worked out. They can sign up. But the answer is we don't know. And let me share with you why. One is that in order for this Obamacare to work, the bottom line is that younger people are going to have to enroll. Mm-hmm. And they don't really have a true financial incentive to enroll. Second is that employers are also not incentivized to keep. In fact, a number of my clients are reducing the number of hours of their employees from full-time to part-time, so they're not covered under this plan. And so we're actually seeing incentives being of reducing hours. In fact, union leaders have raised this as a big concern. And third, the bottom line is that you have some real issues around what's called the family glitch in the bill. That so let's take a secretary who works in a law firm, who a law firm provides insurance to that secretary, but also has a family, but doesn't carry the family piece of it because they can't afford it and the company doesn't provide it. Mm-hmm. There is no place for that person to go and participate in any of these exchanges. So a large number of our uninsured are children, and in this case, with the family glitch, they're not real. There's no way to bring them on to be insured under that scenario. So I don't think there's some design flaws inside the bill that are simply not, I doubt that they're going to achieve the goals that were set out.
Jason Altmaier, could you address this family glitch business?
It was a mistake, having been there during the drafting of the bill. Nobody.
Now, when you were in Congress and you were a Democrat, you voted against the Affordable Care
Act.
That's
right. Yeah, I had some district-specific concerns, and I spent my entire career in the healthcare industry, so there were things at that time that I thought could have been done better, but that's in the past now. Moving forward, we have to make sure that this is beneficial to the citizens of Florida and to everybody in the United States. Nobody benefits from failure. I don't think anyone is rooting for failure. We have to
Are
make
you sure,
sure
about that?
Well, outside of Capitol Hill, perhaps. But I think most of America, regardless of the politics that occurred 3.5 years ago, they root for the country. They want this to be of benefit to their friends and neighbors and the people that need health care in this country. So we're going to do everything that we can as Florida Blue to get out there to try to get as many people enrolled and make people aware of what their options are under the law. And there are some glitches in the law. And the family glitch, as Ed talks about, deals with a specific circumstance that was an unintended consequence in the bill where spousal coverage is not included and then they can't go into the exchange to offset the lack of coverage that they're getting from their
Could
employer.
Could you explain that in clearer terms?
Well, sure. The employer is obligated to offer coverage to the employee, not to the family. Some employers have chosen to only exercise that option and not extend coverage to the family. So the spouse, in the case Ed talks about, in some cases, not every case, doesn't qualify for a subsidy to go out and seek their own insurance because they're not covered under their spouse's employer's insurance. That's a mistake in the bill, and that's something that could be easily corrected if Congress was able to work together. I think everybody on both sides agrees that, that was unintended. But Congress is so incapable of working together right now, those are the kind of things that are going to fall through the cracks.
Just one question. They're not eligible for a subsidy, you're saying, but they are eligible for health care.
Well, they could go out if they were going to pay full price for health care. And again, this is a narrow group of people. It's not everybody that falls into that category. But for those who fall into that glitch, they can go into the market and buy a health insurance policy for themselves and the rest of their family, but they're not going to qualify for a government
subsidy. Who does qualify for a subsidy at this time?
People up to 400% of poverty, which for a family of four is about $95,000. It is scaled up from the poverty level up to 400%. So if you're scaled down, so if you're at 400% of poverty, you're going to get a very limited subsidy. But after that point, you don't qualify for the subsidy.
And Edward Pozzuoli, could you address the effect that Florida's foregoing of Medicaid funds and also the ban on navigators for the uninsured, what effect that will have on Floridians? And what was the reasoning behind that?
Well, you'd have to ask the legislature and the governor the reasoning behind it. But I would say this way, that we talk about this family glitch provision being a problem in the bill. It's an unintended consequence. This is a 2,000-page bill that was passed without any – in fact, Jason voted against it, as well as many other Democrats, but every single Republican voted against it. And so what you have now is regulation being supported around that bill that's going to have a number of unintended consequences. And I'll share one with you. The idea that you're going to be able to keep your insurance and keep your doctor, the fact of the matter is that you may not. And there's going to be tremendous changes. And so the relationship between you and your doctor may be impacted by this bill, depending on who you are.
What do you mean by that?
Well, so as an example, there's a number of large companies. This is a good example as to why the bill is not ready to go live today. The president himself has provided waivers on the corporate side and the company side of this, and the only thing that's going forward today is the individual mandate.
Mm-hmm.
There's a question as to whether that's even legal, whether he can do that. But put that aside. What you have is, so as an example, my law firm, we're going to experience a 30% increase based upon best protections for starting January 1 across the board. So what do I have to do? I'm going to have to reduce the number of hours, and I can't because I'm a larger law firm. I can't get under 50. There's just no way for me to do that. But I will tell you, clients have come to us and worked through structures in which they can reduce the number of full-time employees to underneath the magic 50 number of employees. So what you're going to end up with is you're going to have not only more part-time workers making less money, but you're also going to have no obligation for those part-time workers to have any insurance whatsoever from the company, and they would have otherwise provided it. So you're actually working backwards. Not only are you going to get higher costs, but you're going to get less people covered. That's the danger here in this bill.
But why are they doing that? Why wouldn't they want to cover their employees?
Well, it's a cost issue. So if the cost is going to go up 30%, across the board, as an example, there's going to be a discussion around how much can we pay. From a company standpoint, how much can we pay to support health care? So there's only so much money to go around. What you'll end up doing is taking, instead of spending on an additional employee and expanding your business, a number of clients have told me they're not going to expand their business because they're anticipating a greater cost to carry for health care benefits. And the only way this bill even comes close to working is if by chance the younger, healthier people who are currently uninsured actually enroll in these exchanges. And there's no encouragement to do that because the penalties are only $95 a year or 1% of their total income.
But that's supposedly going up, is it not, with each year? The penalty goes up.
Every year it'll go up.
Yes.
But think about this. Someone made a conscious choice because they're 28 years old and they're in good health not to have insurance. I think that person has the right to choose. Under this new act, under Obamacare, they don't have the right. If they have the right, they can pay the penalty or pay the insurance premium. But until the financial incentive is to actually go to the insurance and pay for the insurance, then you're not going to get the benefit even under the best case scenario of what the plan calls for.
Jason Altmaier, your views.
I think Ed is right about the employer motivation. It's somewhere between $10,000 and $15,000 per employee on average for the average employer currently to give coverage to their employees. The penalty to not offer coverage is $2,000. So if you're looking at it from a purely financial standpoint, and you know that your employees, if you don't offer coverage, are able to go into the exchange, get a wide menu of options, qualify for a subsidy to offset the costs, some employers are going to make the determination it's better for them as business owners and their employees to go into the exchange.
What about a humanitarian standpoint?
Well, there are other reasons why employers offer health care coverage, is to attract and retain talent. Some of them view that benefit as a very important benefit for the people that they're employing, and they want to have that relationship. But if it's a purely financial decision, the incentive might be to drop coverage because you know your employees are going to be able to go into the exchange anyway, and they're going to get covered either way.
But then they could go to a competing firm or whatever, and then you're losing a good employee.
If they were unhappy with the exchange. Now,
right.
The employer mandate doesn't kick in until 2015, not 2014.
We're speaking with Edward Puzwali. He's an attorney and president of Florida-based Tripp Scott Law Firm, and Jason Altmaier, senior vice president of public policy, government, and community affairs at Florida Blue. On today's Topical Currents, we're going to take a short break. We'll come back. We're going to take your calls and your emails. Stay with us.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. We're speaking with Edward Puzwali, an attorney, also Jason Altmaier of Florida Blue. We'll be taking your calls also. The number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. You can also get in by email. That's radio at WLRN.org, and you can tweet.
You can tweet at Topical Currents. We do have an emailer, Martin. Why are we talking about the cost of health care when we spend close to $700 billion in defense? Even today, 400,000 defense workers are on furlough compared to many less from other parts of the government. Why does the country never speak about the cost of defense vis-a-vis the cost of other things? Any comment?
I'll let the congressman ask.
Yeah, I think I can handle that one. This is an argument that comes up in budget season. Today's the beginning of the fiscal year. We have a interesting scenario with the government shutdown, but even in normal years, right around October 1st, when everybody's thinking about the budget, you always get asked, what's the benefit of all these other programs that people don't see as valuable as the programs that they care about? The fact is, defense is the largest line item in the federal budget. $700 billion is about right. I think it's actually a little more than that now. We were at war as a country, two different wars. We're scaling back on that. We're out of Iraq. We're coming back from Afghanistan. So I think that the escalation in defense spending is something that you're going to see taper off. But we still want to be as able to respond as a country in the event. You know, there's very uncertain times in the Middle East and other parts of the world, and that's why that number remains so high.
Back to ACA. Discuss the price ranges, these catastrophic, bronze, silver, gold. How do those affect them?
Under the law, insurance companies who participate in the exchanges offer what's called the metal plans because they're platinum, gold, silver, bronze. What it means is your out-of-pocket costs as a consumer. This is the menu of options that you're going to have in the exchanges, which are open today. Your out-of-pocket costs are going to be based upon which level of plan you select. If you select a bronze plan, about 60% of your costs are going to be covered by the insurance. The rest is on you out of pocket. If you choose the platinum plan, it'll cover 90%. 10% will be your out of pocket cost. Now, you're going to pay more for the premium on the platinum plan, but you're going to get a lot more coverage from out of pocket costs. So if you're young and healthy and feeling like you're not going to have a lot of health care expenses this year, they probably gravitate to those lower level plans. But people who like the doctor that they want to choose, they select a specific network, maybe they have some health conditions and high prescription drug costs, they probably want to choose one of the higher end plans. But that's what these exchanges are all about. They're supposed to work like orbits in Travelocity. And you want to pick a flight from Miami to Dallas, what's the first thing you do? You sort by price. But then you see that the first three options transfer you through New Orleans. And you don't want to transfer in New Orleans. You want to go straight to Dallas. So maybe you'll pay a little bit more for direct flight. Healthcare is going to be a lot like that in the exchange. The first thing people are going to look at is price. The second thing they're going to look at is, what about my doctor? Is he or she in my network? Is the hospital I want to go to in the network? What are going to be my out-of-pocket costs for co-payments and deductibles, prescription drug costs? And that's where these exchanges are a great benefit, because you can comparison shop.
You want to add something, Edward?
Yeah, there's nothing different than what Jason just explained to what's available in the marketplace today. So the question becomes, why do we have a federal mandate to have this? And so no one's been able to answer that question clearly and concisely, because what Jason just described was the marketplace today when you go out and purchase insurance. There are a variety of plans and options, a variety of financial commitment and premiums, and a variety of coverages that are provided. There's a number of, in fact, Florida Blue offers a series of different doctor groups that are available to people depending upon the policy that they choose. And so none of this is different than what you already have in place in the private marketplace today.
Actually, there is a difference, because yesterday the chairman and CEO of Florida Blue was on our show, The Sunshine Economy, Pat Garrity, and he said that they're going to be offering fewer plans now with the ACA, and hence there'll be fewer price levels for individuals. Why is that?
Across the state, we're in all 67 counties, and if you think about the requirement for the minimum benefits package, which is in this law, there are 10 categories of benefits every health insurance plan and exchange must offer. It includes prenatal care, hospitalization, emergency care, mental health benefits, 10 categories. So you used to be able to pick and choose based upon what was important to you, and you might say, well, I'm a 58-year-old male. I'm not interested in prenatal care at this point in my life, so you choose a plan without that. Well, you don't have that option anymore. You're going to have to choose a plan that has all 10 of those required categories. So therefore, that narrows the level of
choice. Why is
and
that?
I would say to you, that's exactly the problem with the design of the bill. When you have government saying that you have to offer, I don't need OBGYN coverage or family care. I don't need that anymore. But and I can choose to have a plan if I go out and get an individual plan and that suits my needs. That's what the marketplace does. Instead, what you now have, and what Jason just described again, was government mandates that's going to limit choices, that you correctly pointed out, Bonnie, limit choices to consumers and ultimately raise prices. That's the bottom line here. And that's why Obamacare is so dangerous to the economy.
But let me ask you something. And I asked you this at the break. What's the alternative? Do you think there needs to be health care reform?
I do.
Okay. And do you think that we're entitled? Do you think it's a right or a privilege to health care?
I think that people can choose whether to have health care or not. So I don't think it's a constitutional right, to be blunt, Bonnie.
Okay.
However, I would say that I think there should be encouragement around. So as an example, some of the things that we could do. The Blues operate in Florida. They're not allowed to operate across state lines. So you cannot bring to bear larger pools of people who will ultimately reduce. The larger the pool, the lower the cost of insurance over that pool. So if you allow Blue Cross to go ahead and go to Georgia and create across state lines, a grander plan that deals with, that is not limited by simply the function of geographical-based state lines, that would help the marketplace. There are other incentives that we can provide, both from a corporate standpoint. So as an example, you can provide a tax benefit to corporations that provide health care. The cost of the health care that they're providing can be a tax benefit. Offer tax incentives, and more companies will be incentivized to provide insurance.
How will ACA affect, say, a 25-year-old fast food worker who's working 30 hours a week and has never had any insurance?
If you're working 30 hours a week, then you would be counted for the employee coverage when the employer mandate kicks in.
But I've heard they're reducing some of them to 29.
Right. Well, that's why 30 is the key number. If they reduce to 29, they're not counted, and if an employer is able to get enough employees into that category, then they're not required to offer coverage. But that individual that you're talking about in that scenario would be able to go into the exchange, qualify for a subsidy that would offset his or her costs, and then they would be able to choose a plan, as I described, on the electronic exchange.
So currently there's no benefit to the employer to allow to schedule that employee to work for 30 hours. They'd rather have them work 29 hours. Secondarily, because of the increase in cost, assuming you had full-time employees, you would have that person may not have a job because the cost of the increased insurance would drive the employer to employ less people or not grow as much. That's the danger here.
Let's take a phone call or two. We've got quite a full board. Sam in Plantation. Hi there.
Yeah, hi. A couple of comments. One, I think that if you're going to take employees and only pay them for 29 hours, the better employees are going to go elsewhere. So the market is going to force the employers to pay people for the full 40 hours or lose the better employees. But here's the other thing. In 1986, they passed a law called EMPLA, which requires hospitals to treat the uninsured. That may have made sense in 1986, but it doesn't make any sense now that there's a national health insurance. They should just simply say hospitals don't have to treat people who have voluntarily decided they don't want insurance. They don't make the hospitals, you don't have to fix somebody's car who doesn't want to get car insurance, and the government doesn't pay to replace a house for a guy that doesn't want to get home insurance. Why should we have to pay for people who don't want to get health insurance?
A problematic scenario that's similar to what the caller describes is if you choose to opt out and you pay the penalty as an individual, and then you get diagnosed with a chronic health care condition that's going to be a long-term, very expensive, multiple treatment condition, you can call your insurance company and say, hey, guess what? I made a mistake. I made a bad choice. Can I get coverage now? And the insurance company has to take you. There's a two-week window where they don't have to cover you, but that from that point on, they're part of the risk pool. So if that happens, if the young and healthy people opt out of the system, it is going to affect the cost for everybody else that's left in the risk pool. That's why it's critically important that we do the educational efforts to get people into the risk pool when they're healthier so that they can offset those costs for everybody that's in there.
You had one more point, Sam?
Well, I was just going to say that maybe they should just make it a tougher standard. I mean, you just, you know, you can't do this you can't buy things retroactive, other kinds of insurance, whether it's life insurance, car insurance, or home insurance. They maybe should just simply have a much wider window than 2 weeks. I mean, you don't pay your money, you take your chance. And you got, and I think that's the only way it'll work.
Okay, thank you very much, Sam.
Thank you.
There's also some humanitarian aspects.
Well, that's what I mentioned, you know, like this emailer. Can we legally change a current employee to be an independent contractor if they're already receiving health benefits from our company? We were a small group employer last open enrollment, but we'll be a large group come next year. We have workers that work on a piecework basis rather than hourly, and it's impossible to calculate their hours, which is part of the ACA mandate.
Well, if they're truly independent contractors, then you're fine. But there's a definition, a legal definition around that, and I would be quite careful around moving full-time employees to independent contractor status and then still remaining to treat them as full-time employees.
There'd be some IRS ramifications.
There's going to be some ramifications on that, both from the state and the federal government.
And here's another.
Withholding taxes.
Right.
Well, there's a series of, just not taxes, but also there's, you ultimately have to provide, so if you're going to provide any kind of insurance whatsoever, that there is a list that's provided to the carrier around who are your employees and who you're covering. And if they're truly doing independent contractor work, meaning they're outside of your supervision, direct supervision, and they're doing something independent that is not a recurring, something that's recurring all the time inside of your company, then they're truly an independent contractor. But if they're not, then they're an employee.
And here's another question for you from Mary. You mentioned that some of your clients are cutting full-time workers to part-time in order to avoid having to offer insurance to workers. What are the motivations for your clients? Is it the companies can't afford it, or are they simply more concerned with their bottom line, regardless of if they can afford to offer insurance, or is it a combination?
Well, we can't have it both ways. If we want a greater number of employment opportunities and jobs, we want unemployment to come down, then there's only so much money that a company is willing to spend to have services provided to their employees. And if there's a greater share of that money that's set aside to pay employees that has to go to their health care benefit, there in turn makes it logical that they would only be able to hire a limited number of employees that they would have otherwise been able to hire without the added benefit. So, and there are, just to go back real quick on this, some of the competitiveness requires inside a certain market. Like a legal market, all law firms generally offer health care to their employees at some level. But in the fast food industry, it's a lot easier to control the number of hours. And let's also be honest about that. Those employees don't have a lot of leverage with their employers. So they're going to be left either without jobs or their hours cut. And this runs contrary to the very people that this bill is supposed to help.
Let's take another call. We've got Melissa in Tamarack. Hi there.
Hi there. My comment was around the assertion that nobody understands why there has to be a mandate. And my comment is that everybody that has studied basic economics, they understand that mandate is necessary because people will game the system. And it's something that was advocated by Republicans back in the 90s when Clinton was doing his health care reform, and all of a sudden now that it was proposed by the current president, it's something that seems that they can't understand that this is something that needs to be done. My second comment has to do with the fact about part-time employment and people shifting people towards part-time employment. This is something that is a long-term trend. It is not because of the health care law. I used to sell health care back in the 1990s, and it's something that started then because of the extremely high cost of health care and employers maintaining it. It's something that has become a competitive disadvantage in our country, and we need to address it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Jason?
I will take the first one, and then Ed can take the second one. Regarding the mandate, the caller is absolutely correct. Under this law, insurance companies are no longer allowed to consider somebody's health status when they set rates. So people who used to be denied coverage because of pre-existing conditions and long-term chronic health care conditions, it's a good part of this bill. Thankfully, they are allowed to get coverage. That's one of the positive benefits of this bill. But the issue is, if you're going to put all of those people, the very expensive, high-cost people, into that risk pool, you have to get the young and healthy people into the risk pool, or else it's going to be unaffordable for everybody. And the only way you can do that is if you have a mandate, a requirement that they have health insurance. And the first year, the penalty for opting out is 1% of your household income, or $95. But in the third year, it's 2.5% of your household income and $700 indexed for inflation over time. So I think at that point, the mandate becomes a reality where you get all of the younger and healthier people into the risk pool, and that's going to help defray the costs of the older and sicker people.
But $300 still is a lot less than they'd have to pay for insurance. So what will make them do it? What will make them get the coverage?
Well, again, it's 2.5% of their household income, or $700 after the third year. But, yeah, there are going to be people who opt out, and it's not going to be all people who don't think they can afford it. Some will be wealthy people who choose to not have coverage, to pay the penalty, and they think, well, I can pay for my own health care expenses. So you're not going to get everybody.
Not too many in that category.
Yeah, but if you're going to require that everybody be in the risk pool, that the people with chronic health conditions, pre-existing conditions, have to have coverage, which is a good thing, you have to find a way to get the younger and healthier mm-hmm. people into the risk pool.
And the second part of the question?
The second, my understanding of the question is basic economics. Let's talk about that because I think that's important. Jason touched on this. Essentially, the government is forcing insurance carriers not to look at the health status of those seeking insurance. What does that do? Well, it skews the marketplace, first of all, with artificial barriers. So we're not talking about a free market anymore. We're talking about a government-controlled marketplace that requires a limited number of choices, that doesn't allow the insurer to look at the health status of the applicant, that also doesn't allow the freedom without penalty of an applicant to go in and either buy insurance or not buy insurance. There is a certain thing that this country was based on, and this dilutes our freedom of choice. If you're thinking about, if you're 25 years old, why, if you don't want to have insurance, why should you have to buy insurance? It's a government mandate. That is the basic problem here, and it impacts, this is not a free market anymore. The blues are stepping up, I understand, but the limited choices, rising rates, think about it. Anything that the government has touched, is it really efficient? You got to think about that.
And we'll take another caller.
I just was wondering, isn't this very similar to Romney's plan for Massachusetts, which seems to be working?
It's different in a couple ways. And I don't know the details around the Romney Care, if you want to say it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a state opting in and having buy-in, by the way, on in basically 90% of the people in that state agreed to that. And that's a perfect example of how the states over the years have been incubators for ideas, different methods that are good for their people. But to try to fit a one-size-fits-all Obamacare on a federal level and try to apply it to all the various parts in Florida, all the various regions in Florida, notwithstanding California and Utah, Texas, who have totally different
needs. But a very
needs.
Conservative Supreme Court gave it a go-ahead.
Well, they called it a tax. But legally speaking, whether it's legal or not, the Supreme Court said it was legal. They described it a tax. John Roberts was the swing vote. He said it was a tax, and they made it constitutional. Doesn't make it good policy.
But as I asked you before, what's a good alternative other than giving, you were saying, if corporations did provide health care for their employees, but what about the average person that can't get insurance?
Well, there's a couple things that are already in Florida law that before this health care, Obamacare came into being. So those who have been insured are not fearful anymore in Florida of being dropped because they develop a condition. And then when they want to change their employer, remember in days gone past, if you switch jobs, you're always concerned about whether you can keep your insurance, even if you had a chronic condition or a pre-existing condition. Mm-hmm. Under Florida law, that's not allowed. That has nothing to do with Obamacare. So if you switch jobs and you go from WLRN to another radio station and they offer insurance, whether you have a pre-existing condition or not is not something they can deny you. And so that's a question of Florida law. So one of the basic things is pre-existing conditions are protected under that instance. The key here, and in Florida, we also have Healthy Kids that provides insurance or some medical care to that goes after the largest segment of uninsured, which are children. And so that actually works in Florida. There's a large number of socioeconomic disadvantaged kids who are involved in that program. That already exists. That's a statewide program that works in Florida. That's going to be impeded by this because the resources are going to have to be moved from that. That's another danger here.
Do you agree with that, Jason Altmaier?
Well, I think depending on your personal circumstance, it's going to determine whether or not you pay more and whether or not you like this bill or not. If you're somebody who currently has health care through your employer and you like it, and your employer chooses to make a different decision.
How about people like that I know who are staying in jobs that they hate merely to keep themselves and their family with health insurance? Will they be able to change jobs and be insured?
Over time, I think because you're going to see employers decouple health benefits from the employer benefits that they offer, you probably are going to see a change in that where you won't be tied in.
Not yet.
Well, I think you're starting to see it because of the law coming in. But I think over time, when employers make that determination, and then if you leave that job, COBRA won't be as much of an issue for employers either, because the former employee will be able to go into the exchange in the period of time when they're not covered.
Speaking of COBRA, I've got a caller who wants to address that. Richard in Miami. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yes, it's very timely. I've been on COBRA now for 12 months. After working 37 years full-time, I'm on disability now. You only get 18 months of COBRA. And I happen to have a Florida Blue PPO plan through my former group. So my question is, should I be reaching out to Florida Blue for coverage under the new plan, or should I be going through the healthcare.gov website?
In specific to the caller, I would ask you to go to floridablue.com or visit one of our retail sites near you, and we can sit down with you and talk about your personal circumstance and what would be best for you. In general, with regard to COBRA, and for the audience, COBRA is whenever you leave a job, the employee has the ability to pay 100% of the costs to stay on the employer's plan. The people who choose to do that often are the people with higher health care costs because they need the coverage. It's more cost benefit to them. So the employer, then, their risk pool is offset because of that, and the employer's costs go up in return. So it's an unpopular program among employers, but it's very beneficial to people who leave the system. And now, because of the new law, you'll be able to go into the exchange. You'll have a menu of options to choose from rather than only having the choice of staying at 100% of the cost on your former employer's plan.
Robert writes, this is understandably a complex subject, but leaving out key points distorts the matter, such as the young will get old and the premium differential should be fair over a lifetime. Spreading the risk, too, allows for no pre-existing condition exceptions. Three, the problems the attorney cites existed before the Affordable Care Act. Employer health care coverage was to a large degree being reduced and becoming more costly for the average employee. And four, before the Affordable Care Act, the private and public, such as Medicare, was facing a funding and delivery crisis that was not being addressed at all. While the ACA needs some tweaks, as any large program would, it's making progress in key areas, health care cost and delivery, versus pre-ACA, no progress, just stagnation in the face of a crisis.
I'll address the Medicare provision and then the cost over the course of a lifetime, and then Ed can do the employer one. That was an argument that was made during the debate on the bill when I was in the Congress. That was the case that if you that was presented. If you were young and healthy and you're going to pay more today, eventually you're going to be old. Mm-hmm. You're going to have higher costs, and over the course of your lifetime, that all has a way of evening out. Especially now that they have narrowed the age rating restriction from 5-to-1 variable to 3-to-1 variable, and they've eliminated gender as a way to set somebody's rates.
What does that mean, 5-to-1 to 3-to-1? What are you saying?
Before the law, you could vary somebody's rates by 5-to-1 ratio based upon their age. Older people could pay 5 times more. Now it's 3 times more. And younger women have higher health care costs than younger men. Now it's true that younger males have an equal share of the responsibility on why younger women have mm-hmm. high health care costs. But if you're an older woman, you're going to have lower health care costs than older men. So that was the continuum that people envisioned over your lifetime, regardless of your age, regardless of your gender. If you're in the system all the way through, eventually it all has a way of evening out. That sounds good theoretically, but if you're that 25-year-old male right now, that doesn't sound very good to you. That's one issue.
Edward, you wanted to comment on the email before we go on?
Well, I do think that there are some things that actually were rolled back. So let's take an example, just the health savings accounts that used to be in place, and they were reduced this year. So before, 20, 30 years ago, you would buy insurance, and most of the insurances that you would buy would be a large deductible with catastrophic care. So if you had major medical is what was termed, so you would be able to go, if you went to the hospital for a major surgery, you'd be covered, but you wouldn't be covered for every other thing. And then you would be able to talk to your doctor and understand the cost around what your responsibility is. The way to fix this is very simple, is to allow people greater education around what they're actually paying for health care. And so allow them to talk to their doctor about and give them a greater financial responsibility so they can make choices around that. That will lower the cost in the long run, and insurance will become far more effective. And therefore, when you need it most, when you're truly sick and ill, that you need the insurance and financially speaking, it's there for you. But one of the things that this administration did is they lowered the health savings account. And what the health savings account was is it allowed somebody to set aside pre-tax dollars to go to supplement their deductibles and their co-pays inside of their insurances. This administration cut that in half this year from $5,000 maximum to $2,500 maximum. And so what it allowed, what it did is exactly the opposite. So instead of someone being able to go ahead and set aside pre-tax dollars up to $5,000 and work through the deductibles, therefore they could buy a less expensive insurance and just cover major issues. This administration decided they weren't going to do that. They're going to reduce that. They're going to reduce the flexibility offered to the consumer of medical care. That is a very dangerous thing. They would rather make the decision in Washington rather than you make the decision with your doctor. That's the most dangerous precedent we see with this bill.
Jason, do you agree?
I think these are the arguments that were made in the crafting and the debate over the bill, but you can make arguments that the individual should have the option of paying a higher share if they want. The bill does limit the out-of-pocket costs that are in play, so you have to, as an individual, make the determination what is my best option, and that's where these metal plans come in. If an individual decides they want to pay more, they are going to have a catastrophic plan. If you're a young male, for example, which would have much higher out-of-pocket costs because you don't think you're going to be sick this year. So some of that does still exist in the market.
But the emailer's point was it's not perfect, but it's better than nothing in the face of a crisis. That's what he said. We're speaking with Edward Puzwali. He's an attorney and president of Florida-based Tripp Scott Law Firm. And Jason Altmaier, senior vice president of public policy, government, and community affairs at Florida Blue. Another short break, and we'll be right back.
And we return. We're talking about the Affordable Care Act and how it affects Floridians with Jason Altmaier and also Edward Puzwali. Let's take a few calls. This is Matt in Palm Beach. Thanks for your patience. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Okay.
I had three different points.
Well, let's start with one.
Number one was if you look at the exchange prices that Florida Blues put out, for a comparable plan from last year's premium, they've gone up about 39%. So if you went to the exchange today and tried to purchase a 2014 plan, it's going to be 39% higher than if you purchased the 2013 plan today.
Okay, is that true?
Well, there aren't comparable plans because, again, there are minimum benefits that every plan has to offer. So your plan, because of the mandate, and required benefit is not going to look the same as it did last year. And in the marketplace, every individual is going to have to make that trade-off that I talked about. If you want the direct flight, you're going to be willing to pay a little bit more. On healthcare, if you want access to certain providers, if you want to lower your out-of-pocket costs, you're going to have to make a decision on how much you're willing to pay. There are other carriers in South Florida who've made the determination to offer a little bit less benefits and have much narrower networks, and they come in at a lower price. Individuals are going to have to choose if that's what they want in the market. We think that people are going to want to have an expanded network and greater coverage for their out-of-pocket costs will be lower.
And Melissa writes, the gentleman's assertion that Obamacare erodes freedom is ridiculous. I guess our freedom is eroded when we're forced to purchase car insurance. Furthermore, the market cannot work effectively with regard to health care, primarily due to imperfect information. Adam Smith even subscribed to the notion that the free market doesn't work all the time and there were issues that should be not left to market forces.
Okay.
I
would say it this way, that the market, we're already seeing the impact of the market. So the last caller, Matt's call, 39% increase, and Jason's response that basically said, hey, it's because you're not getting the same plan because of the mandate. And so last year's plan was simpler and more specific as to the needs of the person purchasing the plan. And this year's plan, because of the government mandate, is chock full of government requirements having nothing to do with market forces of the person who's actually purchasing that plan, and therefore higher. So the gentleman sounded like a man a little older. The bottom line is that he probably doesn't care about the pregnancy piece of it, and he doesn't want to buy it. But it's one of those things that's required for him to purchase, and he's actually paying for that, and he shouldn't have to, and that's part of the increase. And so if we want to increase costs, then great. This is a good act, but I don't see the benefit here.
But what about Melissa's point about, well, we have to buy car insurance, and if health care is a privilege, as you think it is, then, and so is driving, why is it different than we have to have car insurance? That's a law.
Well, today, if you're in a car accident, if you're in an accident, put aside a car accident, and your ambulance takes you to a hospital, this law was mentioned before, the hospital has to provide emergency care under Florida law and under federal law. And so what has happened is that a number of uninsured folks are driven into the emergency room because they can't be denied coverage, regardless if the child has a cough or whether or not it's a catastrophic accident. So there has been an attempt made in Florida, so as an example, to drive some of that traffic elsewhere outside of the emergency room to lower the cost of care. And in fact, that actually has worked. In fact, the Blues have been involved with some of the public hospitals in having walk-in clinics available. I mean, one of the largest health providers in the state right now is CVS because they provide checkup care and and vaccinations. Those are quality ways to keep costs down and provide health care for those who... The fact that you don't have insurance doesn't mean you don't get health care in this country.
That's right, but everybody is paying for that.
Everybody's paying for it now. And so what we would instead do is put a government mandate on basically 20% of the economy, the healthcare profession, and let Washington decide exactly how it should work, regardless if you're living in Miami or if you're living in Utah. It doesn't help.
But
there's got to be some level of market.
There's very little preventative healthcare. People are on their last the last straw is to be able to go to the emergency room.
I think that you're right. For purposes of the uninsured, and most of it, we talked about kids. That's exactly what the Healthy Kids Program in Florida does. It helps prevent with preventative care and offers checkups.
You want to take another call, or do we have time?
Why don't you give another email quickly?
Well, Lorraine says, freedom to be ill and then expect others to pick up the tab is the most stupid argument I've ever heard. The USA is the only developed country without universal health care. The best way to do this is to cover everyone with tax payroll, just like Social Security, and then insurance companies will have to really compete to offer supplemental policies.
Well, that's not what happened under the law, and that's what we're talking about today. There were right. other options that were offered up. That was one of them. It did not have the votes to pass, so we ended up where we are today.
By the way, we will be having some links on the Topical Currents Facebook page and also at our website, WLRN.org. And we just about run out of time. I certainly want to thank Florida Blue Senior Vice President of Public Policy, Government, and Community Affairs. He's Jason Altmaier. Also, we want to thank Edward Puzwali. He's a litigator, political advisor, and president of the law firm of Tripp Scott. And he's also the chair of the National Multiple Sclerosis Society of South Florida. Thank you both,
thank you.
Gentlemen,
thank
very
you,
gentlemen. Much. Thank it's you. A very complicated issue.
Thank you.
And thanks for lending an ear. Our apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction by Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. We have free audio archives and downloads of this and previous programs at our website, WLRN.org. More information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like, if you will, so your friends can find us too. Tomorrow's program centers on the topic of divorce. It doesn't have to be contentious and administered by courts, but by agreed-upon mediators. Collaborative divorces can be a sane answer. And today's calendar on this day in 1881, 122 years ago, the birth of William Edward Boeing in Detroit. The first Boeing aircraft was a twin-float seaplane. United Airlines was a spin-off the original Boeing. And on this day in 1924, 89 years ago, the birth of James Earl Carter in Plains, Georgia. The 39th president, he studied nuclear physics at Union College in Schenectady, New York. He was a Nobel Prize winner in 2002. One more while we play Stump the Band. On this day in 1962, 50 years ago, Johnny Carson takes over The Tonight Show with sidekick Ed McMahon. Johnny was introduced by Groucho Marx. Johnny's first guest ever, Joan Crawford. Skitch Henderson led the band. So we leave with a quote from Johnny Carson, whose career started at WOW Radio in Omaha. Quote, "The only thing money gives you is the freedom of not worrying about money." Joseph Cooper here for Bonnie Berman. Next hour, it's Here and Now from NPR News.